and fresh from dinner at our house made me feel weightless for a moment.
No, that's right, the woman said, causing a crashing sensation inside me. I had to cover for one of the telephonists, so I missed them going up. He was going to sneak your sister in as soon as he had the key, to make sure that mad woman didn't see where she'd gone. Seemed a bit over the top to me, but I suppose once you've had a fright like that, you want to make sure you don't have another.
So you never saw them go up?
Well, I saw Frank come back down. I was back on reception again by that time. Poor Frank. He really was in a state, so worried for his wife. I said, why don't you stay with her? But he couldn't. Something he had to do that night in London. I didn't ask too much about it, because, well, he's a charmer, that one. I wouldn't hurt a fly. But you don't get to sell razors that cheap without knowing a few of the wrong sort of people. My husband has to be clean-shaven, you see. He can't bear even a day's growth on his chin. I think it must remind him of the camp. He was a prisoner of war, near Singapore. You knew that, did you? Anyway, I offered to look in on her, but Frank said she'd gone straight to bed. And the bed certainly looked as though it had been slept in next day. Covers rumpled about and that.
Chapter 16. The inside of this drawer smells of old putty rubbers and is stained and marked, but the things it contains are clean and new. Unopened rolls of polo mints, boxes of tissues, sheets of aspirin, a few pictures of a family smiling in various places in Germany have been clipped together. They must be cuttings from a magazine, though I can't think why I'd want them. And there is a packet of lampposts, tiny lampposts with lead through the middle. The right word for them is gone, and I pick one up, trying to remember it, pressing the writing end into the wood of the drawer until the tip breaks off. It's satisfying, and I pick up another just to break it. The doorbell rings. I drop the pencil and bang into a bookcase in my hurry to leave the room. There are two dirty cups on a shelf. I collect them, and in the hall realize one has some tea in it. I drink it up, though it's cold, and then put both cups on the bottom stair. I stumble back. The staircase is at the wrong angle. It doesn't point at the door anymore. I try a couple of steps. They're solid enough. The doorbell rings. Twice. Three times. It's a harsh ring, not at all tuneful. I open the door, and a man bursts through. You really have gone too far, he says. He's waving something, shaking it at me, but it moves too fast and I can't see what it is. I back away, finding myself against the banisters. I can't work out how they can be here. They're in the wrong place. I mean, a bloody advert. It's the fucking limit. The limit, I say, looking at the stairs. They've shifted, and I can't understand it. Yes, exactly. Hey, are you listening? Do you know how the stairs moved like this? I say. The man is in the middle of taking a deep breath. He stops. What? He's familiar, but I don't know him. And anyway, I can't think about him at the moment. The stairs, I say. They've moved. They face the wrong way. How could that happen, do you think? Has there been an earthquake or something?
What are you going on about?
He's very tall, this boy, but stooped, like Douglas. The steps, I say. Douglas. Douglas must have moved them. I can't think what I was going to say. My thoughts have got tangled somehow.
Who's Douglas?
Our lodger. The man seems to crouch very slightly.
Upstairs, is he?
He puts a hand on the newel post, and the banisters shake a little under his weight as he leans to peer up at the landing. Upstairs, I say, following his gaze. Who's upstairs? I looked to the man, feeling a sudden shiver. I wonder who could be up there.
Not only that, but the banisters are in the wrong place.
They're in the wrong place and I'm frightened. I study the man's throat above his shirt collar.
It is raw from shaving. This is Peter. This is Elizabeth's son. I feel my stomach fill with anger.
Was it you?
I say.
Was it you who moved the stairs?
That must be the explanation. It's exactly the kind of spiteful thing you would do.
Eh?
He rubs the back of his neck, frowns. There is silence for a second. I hear a rook cawing, cawing in the distance. I am making fists of my hands.
Must have been money in it for you.
Peter glances up at the landing again.
I haven't moved your fucking stairs, he hisses.
How do you explain it, then?
I don't know. That's how they were built.
Oh, ridiculous.
What a thing to say.
That sort of lie might work on your mother, but it doesn't wash with me.
Shut up about my mother, Peter shouts, raising both hands.
The front door opens behind him. It's Helen. Helen, with the heavy, honeyish smell of wisteria, and the rumble of traffic and the rustle of the orange plastic bags in her hands. These are the ones that make her grimace and feel guilty, the ones she screws up into egg-shaped balls and hides in drawers.
What's going on? She says.
This man has moved my staircase, Helen,
I say.
I think I know why he's done it, but I don't know how. Make him tell me how he did it.
Peter turns to Helen.
Your mother has put an advert in the paper asking people to contact her if they've seen my mum.
He thrusts a folded newspaper at her, and Helen lifts the bags to show her hands are full. Katie slips through the door behind her, picking up some cups from a step. She goes into the kitchen, and I wonder if she will make me some toast. But a moment later, she's back for the bags, untangling them from her mother's fingers.
Better hide these, huh, Mum?
Don't want anyone to know you use plastic bags.
The last two words are said in a whisper, and I wonder if Helen hasn't heard. She doesn't react anyway, only looks at Peter.
An advert, she says.
It's one thing calling me or leaving notes at the house, but this...
Helen finally takes the newspaper. She glances at the folded page and then waves it at me. I try to catch it, but she isn't looking and it misses my hand.
I'm sorry, she says.
I don't know when... How? She could have put it in.
Peter shakes his head. I start to do the same. He shakes his head as he walks out of the house, and Helen darts after him, footsteps crunching across the gravel. Her voice is raised, but I can't make out the words. A car starts up and drives off.
Well, that was a nice welcome home, Helen says, coming back in.
She opens the newspaper she's carrying.
Here it is. Looking for Elizabeth Markham. If you have any information, please call... Oh, God, it's the old house number. I didn't know you'd placed this.
Nope. Wasn't me, I say.
What made you think of doing that, she says. Putting an ad in the paper, I mean.
I peer up at the landing. Women, contact your husbands, I say. Helen hands me the newspaper and goes to put the kettle on.
Contact your husbands. I kept that article, and I gathered any stories I could about people leaving home. Advertisements, too. Men asking their wives to come back or write to them. Parents hoping for news from missing sons. There weren't really that many. The reporter had obviously overestimated for effect. But each one I found seemed to catch at me like a parachute line, my hopes winging their way into the air. I knew, of course, that even if 100 men and women had left without a word, it didn't mean Suki had.
but it was better than the other possibility, that the murderer who had hurt those other two women had hurt Suki too. It meant there was a chance that one day we might find her again. I tried asking Ma which fishmongers Suki went to, but it only made her cry. And Dad was cross. I wanted to find out what Douglas thought. After all, he always read every bit of the paper. But I was beginning to be frightened of him. I couldn't rid myself of the image of his face looming and angry as he'd smeared the lipstick across my cheeks and chin. And though I'd spent hours putting cold cream on just to wipe it off again, I still felt as if a waxy stain lingered. I started to watch him in the house, thinking about how he hadn't seemed to grieve for his mother, and how he had stared at Suki, and how that neighbour had said he was at Suki's house all the time. And I remembered the policeman saying he recognised him, and the food going missing, and the umbrella in his room that was just like the madwoman's, and his saying he was going to the pictures, and then never seeming to have seen any films. If he caught me watching, he'd scowl, and I would think about the film villains he looked like. But sometimes he would duck his head in that old shy way, and I would think, it's only Doug, and feel sorry for suspecting him of anything at all. With no one to talk to, I was left to follow the meagre advice I found in the newspaper cuttings. I looked to see if there were any clues to where Suki might have gone amongst the clothes that Frank had given me, or in the suitcase the police had returned. One man in an article had left a brochure for Torquay in a drawer, and they'd found him that way. I remember Douglas running his hands round the lining of the suitcase and did the same, but I didn't find anything. Eventually, I showed the collection of cuttings to Frank when he took me back to the Five Ways. I was drinking my ginger ale, not very happy about being in a pub with him again. It was quieter, though, what with the shortage of beer, and smelled of damp rather than tobacco smoke. And Frank seemed to know fewer people now. When I showed him the papers, I had a vague idea he might cry, but he didn't.
"So," he said, "you think she's left me? Is that it?"
"Well, wouldn't that be better than the alternative? What happened to that woman at the Grosvenor Hotel?"
"Perhaps."
He was staring into his beer glass, where there was only an inch of liquid left. I looked at the deep lines on his forehead, shadowed under the pub lights, and at the way his hands turned the glass, and I waited for him to finish the drink. "You'd prefer her to be dead?" I asked, but I couldn't believe he'd really want that, and I didn't like saying dead. His hands didn't stop moving, the glass smoothing the skin of his fingers to whiteness, and when he looked at me, it was with tired eyes. He sighed.
"No," he said. "No, of course I wouldn't prefer that. He's a maniac, that man. Did you read the stories through? There's killing, that's one thing. And there's what he did, and that's another."
Frank raised his hands, the last of the beer slopping about in the glass.
"I mean, accidents happen, they happen, and there's nothing you can do. No way of undoing them. But what he did was no accident."
I agreed the man was a maniac and that his killings hadn't been accidental, and I asked Frank again if he thought Suki might just have gone off somewhere, but he refused to discuss it any more. He just wanted me to remember Suki's story, to tell him again how they first met. And then she said, "That's the man I'm going to marry," I repeated, hardly having to remember at all, and watched the beer glass turning and feeling the newspaper twisted up in my hand. "I just know it. He's the man for me." When Frank walked me home that night, handing me a parcel of ham for Ma, and standing again at the corner to watch me go in, I saw Mrs. Winners hovering at her window. She was talking on the telephone as I went past her hedge, and she ran out after me. "That madwoman's been prowling about again," she said, looking along the street. "I've called the constabulary, but I get inside quick-like, Maud." She noticed Frank, but you couldn't see his face where he stood, in front of the street lamp, his hat pulled forward.
"You caught in already?" she said. "Why doesn't he walk you home properly?"
"Dad don't like him."
She chuckled and pushed me on towards home. "Go on, get inside. God knows what that woman is capable of." Frank was still at the corner when I looked back. I could see the lit end of his cigarette. So could Douglas.
"Been with him again?"
he said, giving me a fright. He was standing in our dark front garden, looking out on the road. "What are you doing there?" I said, annoyed.
"Your mum asked me to look out for you. That woman has been here."
Mrs. Winners said, "I suppose you're waiting to hand over our food." He nodded, not seeming to have heard me, and stayed standing in the front garden, staring down the street to the park.
"Have you seen those new houses?" he asked,
though he didn't turn to me, and I wondered if it wasn't a question for himself.
The ground was churned up for months, soil upon soil upon soil, and now it's flat and smooth as anything. You'd never know what was under there.
I moved closer to Douglas, expecting the smell of licorice to breathe up from the earth, suddenly too frightened to cross the wet, shadowed garden alone, and I stared hard into the dark, trying to see what he saw. But I knew he meant the houses across the park, and there was no hope of seeing them from here, even during the day. I tried to remember what the new houses looked like, but all I could think of was the shell of Douglas's old house, with its pictures and ornaments arranged in the exposed room, as if someone might walk back in at any minute.
"People could live somewhere for 100 years and never know what was beneath their feet," he said.
There was a rustle in the hedge, and although it was probably just a hedgehog or something, we both started.
"You'd better go in," he said.
I went round into the kitchen. Ma and Dad were clearing things away.
"Your dinner's on the stove," Ma said, not looking at me.
I told her it was Frank I was seeing that evening, and she'd kept it from Dad. She'd also asked if Frank could get any soap or matches, because there were none in the shops. I held the package of ham up when Dad's back was turned, and her face brightened for a moment before the tired lines fell back into place. I ate my mutton soup, expecting Douglas to come in any minute, but when I went upstairs, he must still have been in the garden. I waited at my window to see him go in the kitchen door, listening to the occasional thuds of ripe apples falling from the tree, and it was nearly midnight when I finally caught sight of him, a black figure against the dark night. By then, I'd finished writing to the murderer, Kenneth Lloyd Holmes.
"You smell funny," I tell Helen, as she bends to put down my tea.
"Smell funny? How?"
She's indignant, though I've hardly insulted her. "It's a sweet smell," I say. "I'll know it in a minute." "It's sweet, but it's not pleasant. It gives me a headache, and it makes me think of the mad woman. It makes me rub at my shoulder as if I'd had a whack from an umbrella."
"Is it the tea?" Helen says, holding her own cup under my nose. "It's fennel."
"Ugh! Yes, that's it. How horrid. You haven't given that to me, have you?"
"No, Mum."
She takes a sip from her mug and then grins.
"I'd forgotten how much you hate the smell. You never used to let Tom and me buy licorice all sorts when we were kids."
She pauses a moment, as if this is a fond memory, though I remember her whining about it for hours when she was a child.
"What are you writing?" she asks. I look down at the paper under my hands. There are just scribbles. Lots of black scribbles on white. I can't read them.
Helen says something about Peter.
"Talk about overreacting.
What does he think you're going to do?"
She pulls out a chair, scraping it along the floor, obscuring her last sentence. I'm staring at a paper full of scribbles. Meaningless scribbles. Except I have a feeling that some of them might be words, and I just can't read them. I want to ask Helen, but I'm embarrassed, frightened. When I look, she's biting the inside of her cheek, staring at me. I wonder if she's guessed about the scribble words. Don't worry, I say. I'll ask Elizabeth. This seems the right thing to say. I smile at Helen for a moment, but there is something not right. I try to remember what it is. An idea keeps slipping away from me. I can ask her, can't I? I look through my notes, but I don't even have to read them. I know already. Elizabeth is missing. I drop my pen and fold the scribble sheet up, putting it in my pocket. Helen takes my hand. She's being nice. Making an effort. I should too. I wonder what I can say. You look nice, dear. She makes a face. I'm glad to have a daughter like you. She pats my hand and starts to get up. Can we go to see Patrick's grave? I ask. I'd like to put some flowers on it. That's done it. She smiles, widely, sitting again. She has dimples, my daughter. Still there, buried in her cheeks at 50. I'd forgotten. It's as if they were hiding and have finally broken out. We can go now, she says. And we get our coats on and get in the car. It's all done in a whirl. We stop at some point and Helen gets out. I hear the doors lock around me. See her mouth something through the glass and run off. The street isn't busy, but the odd person walks past. I don't recognize them, though. I don't think I recognize them. A woman with long dark hair turns the corner and comes towards me. She peers into the car as she goes by and stops, tapping on the window, pointing at me and then at the car door. She smiles and nods and says something I can't quite hear through the glass. I pull at the handle, but the door won't open, and I shake my head. The woman shrugs, waves, blows a kiss, and walks away. I wonder who she was. What she wanted. Helen gets in suddenly, bringing a warm petrol smell with her. Was that Carla? She says. Just now? No, I say. I don't... Who did you say it was? Carla. It's not a name I know. Helen passes me a bunch of flowers and starts the car. Are these for that woman? I ask. Who did you say? No. They're for Dad. We pull out onto the road and I settle back, the flowers dusting me with water. I like being in the car. It's comfortable, and you don't have to do anything. You can just sit. Is he in hospital? Who? Your dad. We stop at a light, and Helen looks at me. Mum, we're going to see Dad's grave. Oh, yes, I say, and laugh. Helen frowns. Oh, yes, I say again. The cemetery is huge, but it doesn't take her long to find the grave. She must come more often than I'd realized. We stand in front of the stone, reading it, silently, because Helen doesn't want me to read it aloud. We stand for a long time. I start to get tired, and it's boring waiting here. Helen has her head down, her hands clasped as if she's praying. She doesn't even believe in God. There's a mound of earth not far from where we stand. Someone's going to be put into the soil. What do you call that? Planted. Someone's going to be planted. I stare at the earth for a long time. Helen, I say, how do you grow summer squash?
She doesn't move, but murmurs her response.
You never stop asking that question, she says. I can't remember if that's true,
though I don't know why she'd lie about it. And I move away to think, drifting towards a great yew tree. There's something frightening about its size, and the way the dark branches block all the light from the ground. The grave here has a flat stone, and the name has weathered badly. Only the date of death and R.I.P. are still readable.
That was the madwoman, I say as Helen catches up with me. Her name was Violet, but everyone called her the madwoman.
How sad, Helen says, standing with her head bowed again.
I think she's overdoing the respectful pose. I screw my heel into the turf. She chased me once, I say. She chased me and stole my sister's comb. She ripped it from my hair.
As I speak, I can feel the strands break, the pain as they tear from my scalp. But it doesn't seem real. I've got my memory wrong somehow.
She watches me, I say. She knows all about me.
Who does?
Her.
My hands are in my pocket, so I point at the gravestone with my elbow. I want to kick the stone. I want to stamp on the earth beneath it. She's always there, always bloody watching.
Helen's head is no longer bowed. She's dead, Mum, she says. How can she be watching you?
I don't know.
I can't think. I pull my hands out of my pockets looking for a note. There's a folded piece of paper with black writing on it, and I scrunch it into a ball. I want to shove it into the earth, push it in where the mad woman's mouth is. But Helen takes my hand and lifts it, crushing the paper between her hand and mine. And in the little gap between our thumbs, I can just read the name. Kenneth Lloyd Holmes. He was the man arrested for the Grosvenor Hotel murder. The man I sent a letter to, asking if he'd killed my sister. I still hoped that Suki had run away, but news of the murders was everywhere, even on the wireless. I said in the letter that I wouldn't tell anyone, but that I had to know if he'd killed her. I described Suki, her hair, the way she dressed, and told him which town we lived in. I thought if he didn't write back, it might mean she really was still alive. And if he said he'd done it, well, at least we'd know what had happened. I couldn't think what to sign after "Yours sincerely." I had a horror of putting my own name. In the end, I put Miss Lockwood and asked the grocer at the top of the road to accept the letter for me addressed to that name. It was Reg's mother ran the shop then. I remember her raising her eyebrows and laughing. "Waiting for a love letter, eh?" she said. "Miss Lockwood. Vanities of vanities." She smiled and tutted, and I blushed and sweated under my coat. I was horribly embarrassed, knowing she would tell Mrs. Winners at least. But she agreed to accept the letter and keep it for me, and that was all that mattered. I tucked the newspaper cuttings away in a drawer and waited. I never got a reply, but I told Frank I'd written the letter when I met him in the Pleasure Gardens one afternoon. "Have you gone mad?" he said,
hardly waiting to let out his lung full of cigarette smoke.
"Rushing to a nutcase like that? What made you think he's got anything to do with Suki?"
He stalked about in front of the bench I was sitting on, drawing violently on his cigarette, so that the paper burnt down quick and bright. He'd arrived with packages of soap for Ma, and chocolate for me. Cadbury's Dairy Milk, which wasn't anywhere in the shops. I bit a piece off, though I'd promised myself I wouldn't eat it till I got home. It was so overwhelmingly creamy and sweet that I forgot for a moment we were arguing, and grinned up at him.
"And if he says he hasn't done it, what does that prove?" he said, thankfully ignoring my grin.
I wrapped the rest of the chocolate up and put it in my pocket. If he didn't do it, then it proves she might still be alive.
No, Maud. It proves nothing.
He flicked his cigarette into the river and shook another from its packet, all the time staring down at me. I had to stop my hand from straying to the pocket with the dairy milk in it.
What exactly did you write?
He asked, once the new cigarette was lit. I told him, trying to remember word for word, but he kept interrupting, repeating my phrases and coughing out smoke.
She has the same look as the other girls you killed. Bloody hell.
I sucked my lips in at my own words. It's true, she does.
Why?
He shouted. And an old couple looked over from another bench.
Why are you doing this, you bloody little idiot? He wasn't even here long enough to have met her. You'll probably just end up as his next victim.
I shrugged and turned away. The man had been caught and would be hanged, so that seemed unlikely. Frank swore under his breath and made off down the path. For a moment I thought he'd left me for good, but he wheeled round before he got to the old couple and swung his hand up to tear the cigarette from his lips. It was a strangely airless day, like being indoors, and the smoke hung between us almost still, though I could hear the wind in the pines far above our heads. "Where did you used to take Suki dancing?" I asked, wishing I hadn't told him about the letter, wanting to make up, wanting to get back onto old ground.
"The pavilion. Why? You're going to tell that lunatic you've got a thing for?"
I flinched at his tone, and he let out a long breath, flicking his second cigarette away and coming to stand in front of me. I'd given in and unwrapped the chocolate bar again, and when he leant down to take my hands in his, it began to melt between us.
"We always went to the pavilion," he said, "and she even used to make me dance before the interval. I've never done that before. One thing I remember that you don't, eh?"
He shook my hands lightly, and one side of his mouth curled up in a smile. I smiled back, like always. "I remember now," I said. "Perhaps I'll go there to look then." He let go of me and the chocolate bar landed on my lap, a little lick of it blotting my skirt.
"Why can't you leave it alone?" he said.
And I thought he meant the chocolate and answered, "You bought it for me," before I realized he was talking about my search for Suki. But I couldn't leave it alone, and I wore Suki's green scallop dress to the Saturday night dance at the pavilion ballrooms. There was a chance, I thought, if Suki was still in the town, even if she didn't want to contact us, didn't want to know us. There was a chance that she wouldn't be able to resist going out dancing. It was as good a bet as anything. And I thought, I would just go there to watch and see who turned up, making sure she wouldn't spot me by curling my hair into a new style and bringing a copy of Mars, Britannia and Eve magazine to hold in front of my face. The pavilion ballrooms had a large foyer with red velvet benches and palms in big china pots. There were wicker chairs dotted around the pillars, but they seemed more conspicuous than the benches. Anyway, when I arrived, all the free ones faced away from the door, so I wouldn't have been able to watch who was coming in. I sat on a bench in the corner and held the magazine up. The dance was due to start in the main ballroom, and occasionally people came in the foyer to sit and wait, chatting to each other, laughing, or jiggling their legs in anticipation. The air began to fill with a mix of perfume, shoe polish, and mothballs from all the dresses left in wardrobes during the week. I'd got there early, so I could watch for Suki, and had a quarter of an hour until the orchestra started. I half read an advert for Dr. Williams's pink pills, and half watched the door. My heart was beating hard, and each beat seemed to send the blood straight to my arms, so that it was difficult to keep the magazine steady. At one point, a man came in, and paused on the threshold, scanning the room. He was tall and had a blonde moustache, and his clothes looked as though they belonged to a fatter man. I sat up a little, watching him, as a neat woman in a violet dress came out of the ballroom and called his name. Her voice seemed familiar, and her hair was a soft, dark colour. I hardly dared look at her, breath pooling in the top of my lungs. The man waited till she was near, and then put an arm round her shoulders, and the woman helped him across the foyer to a wicker chair. He limped badly, and I thought he must have damaged his leg in the war. As they came closer, I could see the woman was plump and more motherly than Suki, and though she was light on her feet, she wasn't as elegant. I was numb to the disappointment for nearly a minute before it began to pinch like a stitch in my side. I pretended to myself that it was hunger and searched for the last of the chocolate Frank had given me, but I must have left it next to my bed or in the pocket of my school coat, because I couldn't find it. It was nearly six, and the light from outside was very yellow. The colour was reflected onto everyone's clothes and hair by great mirrors fixed to the walls. The corners still had bits of brown paper stuck to them where they'd been covered to protect them from air raids. I was sitting in the bottom left corner of one mirror, and, feeling desolate, I turned and raised a hand to pick at the brown paper. It was satisfying, tearing it from the smoothness of the glass, and I'd removed about an inch of it when someone came up behind me.
"Suki?"
a voice said, and I turned. It was Douglas. He closed his eyes when he saw it was me. His mouth opened, and his chin jutted out.
"Maud," he said, "I should have known."
He dropped onto the bench next to me, stretching his legs out, and the limping man in the wicker chair glanced across at him. I waited for Douglas to say something, but he just stared at his feet. "Why are you here?" I asked finally. "Did the madwoman tell you to come?"
"I come every evening there's dancing," he said, "in the hope."
"Yes," I said, not wanting him to finish the sentence. "You come here instead of going to the pictures. In the hope."
"That's why you're here too."
I nodded.
"Wearing her clothes? Sure you're not meeting Frank?"
"Oh, for God's sake, Doug," I said. "It's not for Frank. And even if it were, what business is it of yours?" He gave me a brief, bitter glare, and I huffed and tutted, repeating my sentence, muttering it to myself, trying to be angry with him. "How long will you go on coming here?" I asked.
"As long as I can bear it."
We faced away from each other, towards the sudden bustle of the foyer. The dance was starting and people were heading in.
"I don't know where else to look," he said. "I don't know what else to look for."
I nodded, studying the side of his face. I really loved him then. Loved him for carrying on, for caring enough to carry on when Frank had given up. "Doug," I said, needing to know one more thing. "You and Suki?"
"She was kind to me, that was all," he said, gazing intently at the departing dancers. "Gave me somewhere to go. Someone to talk to."
I wanted to ask what it was they talked about, but I didn't know how to without it sounding like a challenge. I always seemed to worry at Douglas, taunting and nitpicking, though it was never what I meant to do, and I didn't want to risk saying the wrong thing now. I also couldn't help feeling left out and resentful, despite it being far too late for that. Douglas looked blankly at the backs of jackets and cocktail dresses, and I watched the way the colour came and went in his cheek, and the way his soft hair ruffled in the draught from the door. And I smiled at him, though he didn't see it. I meant to go back with him the next Saturday, but when I suggested it, he didn't seem keen, and I missed him leaving, or I was out, or busy. I tried the next week, after I'd been to my friend Audrey's for tea. Ma and Dad had gone up to London again to try to talk to someone about Suki's case, but Audrey had pinched a bottle of gin from her father and insisted we drink it, despite us both hating the taste. By the time I arrived at the ballrooms, the dancing was finished, and Douglas was long gone. The sky darkened as I walked home. It had been raining, and the pavements by the new houses were shiny, and snails were making suicide dashes from every neat front garden. The smell of wood stain was in the air, curling off the freshly constructed fences. Soon I couldn't see the ground in front of me, and I was stiff with the fright of crushing a shell. I could already feel the way it would collapse under my shoe, hear the crunch. When I was younger, I would have edged forward slowly, picking up each snail and carrying it to the safety of a garden, or at least to an opposing shrub. But I'd grown out of that, I suppose, and so I just watched for the glint of syrupy flesh as I walked, and followed the silver stream of their tracks, trying not to commit my feet to any area of ground. I'd made it halfway down the road when I heard the first hollow grind against the pavement. But I hardly had time to curse, barely a moment for that sick feeling, a mixture of sorrow and disgust, to envelop me. Because in the same instant, I saw the madwoman. She was on the other side of a car, the only one parked on the street, standing in the wet road and peering through two windows worth of glass. Her fingers curled uselessly against it, her scratching unable to find purchase. It was the light from a house, switched on suddenly, that had exposed her, sending her shadow slipping towards me. A man had come out into his front garden and was shouting, and people had started to collect around him. He stood by his garden wall, running his hands over the top of it, where he or someone had cemented on a lot of coloured pebbles. Neighbours had come to hear him, and he shouted all the louder, but I could hardly concentrate on his words because of the madwoman who was tapping on the car's window. She seemed to shiver in the light, her white hair fluttering like a moth. We stared at each other through the glass, and I wondered how long she'd been there, whether she had followed me along the road or had been waiting there, hiding. I wondered what her plan was, whether she had a plan. I felt paralyzed, my foot still suckered to the pavement by the snail carcass, and I thought for a moment the man was shouting at her. But I was wrong. Someone had been trying to dig up his summer squash, he said, and they'd nearly got away with it. He was a prize squash grower, and his crop was just swelling to perfect size. He was certain it was sabotage. He'd even seen the back of the digger as he'd run away, and he could swear it was old Mr. Murphy who was his chief rival. It was the white hair gave him away. It gleamed in the moonlight, he said, making the gleaming itself sound like a crime. I could tell his hair anywhere I could. Bastard! Some ladies muttered and he apologised for swearing. A man suggested they go and knock up Mr. Murphy and get him to show his hair. There were chuckles and the murmuring of people fast losing interest. In a moment it would be pitch black and quiet again, and yet I still couldn't move. The madwoman's eyes were fixed on me, her fingers tapping out some kind of demented Morse code, but it was the sight of her hair shining that made me shudder. It was she who had been digging in that man's garden, I thought. It was her white hair he'd mistaken for this Mr. Murphy's. And I imagined her out there in the dark, fingernails full of dirt, pressing the flesh of the summer squash against her teeth. There was a call of, "Good night, good night," as most of the women went back inside to tend to children and wirelesses and hair curlers, their men following. But a straggler, with a kind of winking voice, suggested that the culprit was one of these summer squash addicts. And a shout of disproportionate laughter made the madwoman turn, just for an instant. And I ran.
along the street and past the squash grower, maiming more snails as I went, and not even lamenting their injuries. Knowing I would find splinters of shell and gluey flesh on the bottom of my shoes the next morning. Chapter 17.
My house is dark when I get there. Ma and Dad are out looking for Suki. I stand on the front porch trying to find my keys, checking my bag and each of my pockets twice. The keys aren't there. My stomach seems to float into my chest and my heart beats against it. I breathe carefully in and turn out my pockets, shaking everything onto the ground. The rattle of the contents hitting concrete is mixed with that old familiar sound of my front door opening. The click of the latch, the heavy creak of the hinge. Someone who isn't Ma and isn't Dad is opening the door. It's a man, youngish, small and fair, who stops just inside and stares at me. He seems startled, as if he didn't expect me home. He doesn't look like a burglar. I stare back, disbelieving. I don't think I recognize him, but I don't trust myself. Douglas, I say. No, I'm Sean, he says, backing into the house. My house. Stay there, he calls. But I've no intention of waiting outside while he does God knows what inside, and so I follow him into the dark hallway. There's something funny going on. Everything's different. The shelf above the radiator's gone, and there's a bike propped against the wall. I can't think where I am. There's a smell of vinegar, and the man is on the phone. He smiles at me, showing off, just like Mrs. Winners. Do you need to sit down? He says, covering the mouthpiece with his hand. They won't be able to hear you like that, I say. He nods and takes his hand away, says something into the phone and puts it down. Would you like to come into the kitchen? We've just had fish and chips. Lots of chips left. A small child slinks up the steps, keeping close to the wall, and studies me from behind her father. Poppy, the man says, this is the lady who used to live here. Don't you live here any more, then? I ask. The girl squirms into laughter. Well, shall we go through? He walks down the steps, and the girl twists away and runs down before him. I'm not sure what to do. I can see a light on in the kitchen, but I can't think how to get there. It all seems so familiar, as if it should call up memories, but I can't reach them. There's a layer of other people's lives on top. I look at the front door, still open. It's just like mine, the same glass in the window panes, and it makes me think I should be getting home. Only I'm stranded on this bit of carpet, and there's no way out. I feel in my pockets for notes, but there's nothing there, just a few threads and emptiness. I've no notes at all. The lack makes me feel sick. I'm cut loose and whirling about in the wind. I wring the fabric of my coat, scrunching up and down in panic. And then, inside the ripped lining, I find one small blue square with my writing on it. Where is Elizabeth? Elizabeth is missing, I shout. I shout, so the part of my brain that forgets will stop forgetting. Elizabeth is missing! I shout it again and again. When I look over my shoulder, there is a small girl holding on to the banister, half hidden under a mass of those things for winding round your neck. Wool and silk, long and deadly. They hang limply over the newel post, like clever snakes pretending to be asleep. The girl widens her eyes at me and then shoots up the stairs. I shout in her direction. And then I feel a hand on my shoulder. The weight of it makes me hunch into the front door. Mum, someone says. It's Helen. She rushes to put her arms around me,
pressing my face against her collarbone. She smells like wet soil. When she stands back, she gives me a little shake with one hand. Her phone is in the other. "Who were you shouting at?" she says. Her eyes run over my face and the hand on my shoulder squeezes. "Mom, you don't live here anymore. You know that, don't you?" "Elizabeth is missing," I whisper, looking up at the house. "It's familiar, but I don't know whose it is." I put a hand to my throat.
"No, Mum, she's not. You know where she is.
And you have to accept it.
Or you have to let it go. And either way, you have to stop telling people that."
She speaks very low and starts to lead me away towards the road. "Telling people what?" I ask.
"Elizabeth is missing.
You think so too?" Her face freezes into a closed-eyed smile.
"No, Mum. Never mind. Let's get home, shall we?"
She opens a car door and helps me in, and then goes back to the house to gather some things that have been strewn over the path. A man bends to help her.
"Thank you so much," I hear her say. "I was only out 10 minutes. I thought it would be okay."
He says something I can't catch.
"I know. I know it isn't the first time." She's still adjusting.
I try to make sense of it, but it's impossible. There's such a jumble in my head. My house and strange people and Katie on the stairs and fish and chips for dinner and Suki gone and Elizabeth gone and Helen. Gone? But no, Helen's here getting into the car and driving me off somewhere. I look back the way we've come. "Helen," I say, "I moved house, didn't I? I moved in with you."
"Yes, Mum,"
she says. "That's right." She reaches a hand out for me but has to take it back to change gear. "Well," I say, "at least I've got one thing right today." I watch the road swerve about in front of me with satisfaction, and Helen doesn't stop me reading the signs aloud. I concentrate very hard on them. They are solid and unjumbled, and I don't have to understand what they mean because I'm not driving. A man wavers ahead of us, thin and fragile looking. I think at first he's hovering on a single slender leg, but soon I see it is one of those things to move about on. Two wheels, handlebars. Not a wheelbarrow. We catch him up and pass very close, and for a moment I think he will be pushed off centre. We'll make him topple, one touch on a spinning top. My insides go tight. "Helen," I say, "you nearly knocked him down."
"No, I didn't, Mum."
"You did. You nearly got him. You ought to be careful. People can die from that."
"Yes, I'm aware.
But I was nowhere near him. That poor woman got knocked down in front of our house." "When was that?"
"I don't know. I don't know who you're talking about."
"Yes, you do. She was standing over my bed and then she ran away and you knocked her down so she wouldn't come back."
"I have never knocked anyone down."
"Well, I don't know," I say. "I wasn't in the car at the time."
I was in Douglas's room, playing the champagne aria. I heard the sudden screech of car brakes over the deep laughter of Ezio Pinza, and then my mother's voice calling.
I couldn't make out her words as I banged through Douglas's door and followed the shouts out onto the street. But I soon saw the huddled shape in the middle of the road. It was the madwoman. She lay on the ground, her head bleeding, her arms and legs at funny angles. Ma was kneeling over her, a hand on her cheek. Mrs. Winners must have heard the noise too, as we arrived at the same time. She hurried back inside to use her telephone to call an ambulance, and Ma sent me for blankets to cover up the misshapen limbs. After that, I didn't know what to do, so I just knelt by Ma and held the madwoman's hand.
Her eyes rolled about, and she whispered things I couldn't catch. But she didn't seem so frightening now, crumpled up and tiny on the tarmac. She didn't even have her umbrella. There were bits of plants lying by her sides, things she'd had in her hands when she fell. Stripped hawthorn twigs, red nasturtium flowers, brook lime and dandelion leaves, honeysuckle, watercress, and lemon balm. They lay scattered about her, so she looked like an old Ophelia who'd mistaken the road for a river.
"It's all stuff for eating, look," Mrs. Winners said. "Dandelion leaves, nasturtiums. Making herself a salad. Not so daft after all."
When I began to gather up the leaves and flowers, the madwoman made a harsh noise in the back of her throat. Ma bent to hear her words, and the woman, with her eyes on my face, found my hand and pushed something against my palm. I took it, unresisting, feeling the thing, small, delicate and crisp, but not looking down at it.
"Birds,"
Ma said, trying to catch the low words.
"What birds? Whose head?"
But she couldn't seem to get any sense from the woman, and so we just made soothing noises while Mrs. Winners paced about, wondering loudly where the ambulance had got to, and asking whether we thought she ought to make use of her telephone again.
"How old do you think she is?"
Ma said to me, adjusting the blanket so it lay as lightly as possible over the mad woman's jagged form. I told her I didn't know. "Does it matter?"
"I don't suppose it does. Only she's younger than I thought. Might even be my age."
By the time the ambulance arrived, the madwoman had stopped whispering. Her mouth had stretched open, and her cheeks had turned concave. There was a moment when she seemed to come round. Her eyes met each of ours in turn, and she closed her jaw once as if trying to say one last thing. But then a dark trickle of blood ran from the corner of her mouth, and she faded back.
"She died in my arms," Ma said, as the men took away the small figure, still wrapped in one of our blankets.
We, all of us, stared down the road for several minutes, long after there was anything to see, and Mrs. Winners was the first to shake herself and rub her hands and glance up at the sky to decide if it looked like rain. Eventually she ushered us into her house for tea.
"Was bound to happen," she said, settling us into her front room. "Always in the road, that one, jumping in front of buses."
"It wasn't a bus that got her," Ma said. "It was a Morris."
Mrs. Winners said she didn't see how that made a difference.
She switched on her little electric fire and put a shawl round my mother's shoulders before pouring the tea, and I realised Ma was shivering. I asked her what the matter was, but Mrs. Winners made a face and waggled her head, and I knew to shut up.
"What have you got there?"
she said, nodding at my closed fist. I put down my cup and finally opened the hand that held the mad woman's gift. It was a flower from a squash plant, dry and faded, and falling apart, like an old gramophone horn.
"From the woman, was it? Summer squash flower by the looks. A real treasure, I don't think. What did she give you that for?"
"You can eat squash flowers, can't you? Same as nasturtiums. But I think it might be because she dug up some squash in a man's garden," I said.
"He nearly caught her digging them up.
I was passing, and she knew I'd seen her."
I thought of the man shouting to his neighbours in the dark and running his hands over the pebbles on the wall.
"And that's her confession?
Blimey, she was balmy. Oh, I don't wish to speak ill of the dead. And she was honest, I suppose, in her own way. I'm fairly partial to summer squash myself."
"It was Frank who helped plant them," I said to Ma, thinking she might react if that was significant. But she only nodded, cradling the warmth of her cup, but not drinking.
She said all the little birds were flying round her head, Ma said. Like one of those cartoon films at the pictures. And then she talked about her daughter. Told me we'd both lost our girls. I suppose she meant Suki. I didn't think she knew anything about me. You wouldn't expect her to be aware somehow. But she kept talking about our girls.
Sounds like ravings to me, Mrs. Winners said.
No, Ma said. She knew me.
It's just for the weekend, Mum. I'm sorry, but I'll be back on Monday morning to take you home.
Mum?
I don't say anything. We're in a small room with plain blinds and pretend flowers in a vase. There's a strong smell of cheap gravy coming from somewhere, and disinfectant. Helen is crouching by the bed I'm sitting on. She says she'll be back, but I know she's lying. I know she's going to leave me here forever. I've been here weeks and weeks already.
It's only two nights, and they'll let you do some gardening.
I don't like gardening, I say. And then I'm annoyed at myself for answering.
Yes, you do. You're always asking about planting vegetables, and you certainly seem to enjoy digging things up when we're at home.
I remember not to answer this time. She's lying about this too. I never liked gardening. I'm not like her, out in all weathers, telling people where they should gouge the earth to put in great ponds, or explaining what kind of soil is best for growing vegetables. Not that she ever thinks to tell me. She never thinks I might need to know how deep you have to dig to sow summer squash seeds, or how far into the ground the roots grow. I resist asking now. Anyway, the room is empty, except for me. At some point, Helen must have gone, and now I'm just sitting here. There's a notice up on the wall. Welcome to Keeble House. It's an old folks' home, and I can't think why I'm here. I look at my notes and find the home's name is written on a bit of pink paper along with the address. Keeble Road. I used to have a friend here. She's dead now, and I can't remember her name. It wasn't Elizabeth, though. I know that. It was a different friend.
Tea in 5 minutes.
A big, solid young woman ushers me into a corridor with bedrooms all the way along it. I think for a moment of the station hotel, but these doors stand open and I can hear television sets droning on as I walk past, and people calling out in low voices. I catch a glimpse of legs stretched out on beds, of slippers and surgical stockings. There is a constant beeping coming from somewhere. We reach a lounge and the smell of gravy recedes. I'm folded into a chair, facing a lot of other similar chairs, which slowly fill up with old people, their clothes and faces creased as if they'd just got out of bed. Another TV is on in the corner and the noise of it confuses everything. I've been waiting hours and hours, I say to the solid girl.
What have you been waiting for? She asks.
Ages and ages I've been waiting. Over 2 hours.
What for?
But I can't think what for. And the girl sighs, pushing her fringe back with her forearm. She passes me a cup of tea, and I watch an old woman on the other side of the room. There is a bright scarf over the old woman's hair, and she's very bent over. She can't seem to help dipping her nose into her tea as she drinks. Droplets drip off when she lifts her head, soaking her sweater. When she's finished, she puts her head in her hands, taking the weight off her bent back. Someone comes to get her crockery. A man, elegant and smiling, with light brown skin. Spanish, perhaps. I watch him stack cups into a gleaming spine. The sun starts to angle in through the window and he rolls a blind down with a quick movement, like a bullfighter shaking out his cloak. "It's getting late, and I've been here a long time. All the dancers are heading home, but I can't go home yet. I must wait to see if Suki turns up." There's a bit of tape on the seat of my chair, and I begin to pick at it. "When will the dancers leave her alone?" I say, the poem's words clearer than the ones from the television. "She is weary of dance and play."
"What?"
a woman with long white hair barks as she comes in, leaning on a walking frame. "Is someone in my seat? Where the hell is it?" I have a sudden panic that I'm sitting in it, but the Spanish man points to the chair next to me.
"Here it is," he says, dancing to the left and waving at it.
She puts her head down as if she'll charge the chair, but twists at the last moment and lands gracefully.
"You're not doing that very nicely," she says,
pointing to my fingers, picking up the bit of tape. I can't think of the next line of the poem, so I don't know how to answer. I smile instead, trying to sing the beginning, so at least she'll know I remember the tune.
"She thinks it's funny,"
the woman says to a man on the next chair.
"I don't."
She rounds on me again.
"If you went home and told your mother and father that you were doing that, they wouldn't be very pleased."
"She can't go home to her mother, can she?" the man says, brushing some crumbs off his pullover. "No, not yet," I say. "I have to wait here until someone comes. A matador with a great cloak. He's got my sister. He's got her under his cloak, and he won't let her go until I dance with him." No one seems to be listening, and the image of the matador is too vague to hold on to. A dark woman, sitting by a vase of cloth flowers, waves at me. "These are fake, you know," she says, "but quite nice anyway." I look at the flowers and nod. "Fake," the dark woman says again, rubbing the petals between her fingers. She pulls one of the flowers from the vase and hands it to me. "Quite nice, though." I take the flower and close my fist around it as she pulls the whole bunch of plastic stems from the vase and thrusts them at me. They hang their heads sadly without the vase's support, and the petals look worn from handling. There are several stems without any heads at all, and they make me think of Douglas in our kitchen, and the way his stooped back echoed the shape of his shabby bouquet. The electric light was flickering, and ghostly insects had begun to flatten themselves to the outside of the kitchen window by the time Douglas got back. The range had nearly gone cold, and we were drinking the last of the tea. Ma often couldn't sleep, and I sometimes stayed with her, doing the crossword in the Daily Echo, and listening to Dad snoring at the top of the house. "Your dinner's in the top oven," Ma said, as Douglas came through the door. "It might be a bit cold. I'd have done something about it if I'd known you'd be late, but I didn't know."
"Yes, I'm sorry," he said,
not sitting down, but looking as though he might drop.
"I'm sorry, I didn't think, I..."
He had the flowers in his hand, a bedraggled bunch wilting in the heat of the kitchen, petals falling with every twitch of his body.
"I didn't know what to do,"
he said, holding them up to us. He swayed on his feet, and Ma waved a hand at me to do something. "What's happened?" I asked, getting up and pushing my chair into his legs to make him sit.
"My mother," he said. "She died this afternoon."
I flinched. Ma looked worried, spooked even. We must both have thought he'd gone off his head, lost his memory, something.
"Your mother's already dead, dear," Ma said.
"There was a bomb. Do you remember?" She waved her hand again towards the kettle this time, and I filled it with water and put it on the range, adding fuel.
"No," Douglas said. "No. She survived that. I hadn't known at the time, but she survived. And then
Remember, you saw her, Maud. She chased you.
What? You mean the mad...
I stopped myself and rattled the kettle to cover the words I'd nearly said.
But how could she be?
He ducked his head and set the flowers down. I suppose he'd collected them for his mother, and I wondered whether to fetch a vase. But it hardly seemed worth it for such a sorry-looking gathering of roadside weeds.
I thought perhaps you'd have known about Mother already, Douglas said. Suki knew. I told her. She was so kind, tried to help, made up parcels of food. I'd begun to think everything would turn out all right. I don't know how I could be so dense, but I thought it just might be all right.
But Douglas, your mother, Ma said, I don't quite understand.
She'd always been delicate, he said, his eyes shut against the maddening light. Ever since my sister died. Dora was run over by a bus before the war.
We nodded and urged him on, because of course everybody knew that.
And then my dad went to France in 1940 and never came home again. That's when she got a lot worse. Used to be out all hours, didn't sleep, didn't eat. Not properly, anyway. She got into trouble with our neighbours. That's when we lived on the other side of town. The police were fetched. Several times I had to go and ask for her at the police station.
That's how Sergeant Needham knew you.
Did he? Yes, I suppose that's how. Anyway, in the end, we had to move. Did a moonlight flit and used my milk cart to shift everything. I'm not proud of that. But at least it meant no one knew us. I thought that was a blessing. I avoided our new neighbours and kept hold of our ration books so the shopkeepers wouldn't know Mother's name, wouldn't connect her to me. I don't think anyone even knew she lived with me. She kept such odd hours, and she used to sneak about the back gardens rather than use the road. In any case, we'd only moved in a few weeks before those bombs were dropped. I thought she'd gone in the raid. I'm ashamed to say I almost found it a relief. But then it turned out she was living in the wreck of the house. I tried to help her, but she was so difficult. You couldn't make her see sense. She only wanted to stay in the house, bombed as it was, because Dora's dolls and her Woolworth's handbag and her Rupert annuals were still inside somewhere. Poor woman, Ma said, looking about the kitchen and somehow not letting her eyes rest on anything. The kettle had started to boil, and I poured hot water over some beef tea granules, sliding the cup towards Douglas. The smell of it clouded the kitchen and made my mouth water.
We were with her, Ma said, in the road.
Did they tell you?
Douglas sipped his tea in answer, and I took his plate from the oven and set it in front of him. He sat stiffly in his chair, the flickering light giving him a false animation. Ma turned a knife and fork his way and pushed them across the table. She didn't seem in pain, just slipped away. He nodded and then began to eat, neatly and quickly, not looking at us when he spoke.
When they started to clear the rubble from our house, she went and slept in that boarded-up shack on the beach. Then I lost her again for a while, until I found she'd been hanging about at Frank's, living in the old stables. I think she wanted to be near Suki. You see, she looked a bit like my sister.
He took another sip of the tea.
So do you, Maud.
I wondered whether that was what had made her chase me. You had her umbrella, I said. I saw it in your room. He paused over a curl of onion, perhaps wondering what I'd be